Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 220, I chat with Robert Zone, president of Value Electronics, and Mark Henninger, senior writer at AVS Forum, about the Value Electronics 2014 Flat Panel Shootout. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 21st, 2014, episode 220, Value Electronics 2014 Flat Panel Shootout. Help support Twit with your Amazon purchases. Visit twit.tv/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and shop as usual. That's twit.tv/Amazon, and we thank you for your support. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week, I have two guest geeks on the show. First is Robert Zone, the president of Value Electronics, a retailer in Scarsdale, New York, where the 10th annual Flat Panel Shootout just occurred last weekend. Hey, Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here. Appreciate you inviting me.
You bet. Also with us is Mark Henninger, senior writer and social media manager at AVS Forum, my cohort in crime there. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be on the show again.
You bet. Mark was there at the Value Electronics Shootout, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. But before we do, I want to make sure everybody knows that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions about the shootout as we go, and I will pass along as many as I can. So, Robert, this was the 10th anniversary of the Value Electronics Flat Panel Shootout. Tell us a bit of the history. How did it get started? How has it evolved over the years?
Well, cinematography and photography and video and audio has been a lifetime passion of mine. And I was a TV broadcast engineer prior to 18 years ago when I opened this company. And I always wanted to find out what the difference is between the higher end TVs is. So I used to buy them all in our retail store and line them up against each other. And I would do a little tweaking myself and just do my own personal evaluation. About 10 years ago, I decided to make a larger venue and invite the public and webcast it and bring in a professional calibrator to help me better calibrate the televisions and have more test and measurement materials to help us evaluate. It caught on rather quickly, and it grew rather rapidly. About 7 years ago, we brought Kevin Miller and Dwayne Davis and Ed Johnson into it, and it escalated rather quickly. About 4 years ago, David McKenzie joined us from Europe, and it's become a very, very popular event for evaluating high-end flagship televisions each year.
Now, these names you're mentioning are the calibrators that you have brought in to make sure that all the TVs that are in the shootout, and we'll talk about what that really means, a shootout, are on a level playing field, that they're all calibrated fully to be able to produce the absolute best picture that they are capable of doing.
That's correct. And usually people that are videophiles and enthusiasts that buy these televisions have an interest, even if they're doing it themselves, in peaking the performance of it. But the main reason is what you said. Squeeze every ounce out of them, put them on an equal playing field so it's an honest evaluation. And that was the main reason for it, to peak their performance and see how they can compete against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that in high ambient light and also in low ambient light.
Which is good, because there certainly are people who watch TV in high ambient light with the lights on in the room or during the day. Maybe somebody's doing something else in another room. Of course, you and I and Mark are all videophiles and interested in dedicated home theater rooms. But sometimes that's not practical, or sometimes people want to have TVs in a multipurpose room. And we'd like to know how well they perform under those conditions as well.
Very true.
Yeah. So how are the TVs selected? How do they end up being in the shootout?
Well, they have to be a current model. They have to be in production. They have to be a high-end model. And then we bring them in and we evaluate them to see if they can pass the entrance level test, you might say. Hmm. If they perform well in the evaluation, they get put into the event. So it's pretty much each premium manufacturer's flagship model that's evaluated for entry into the event. This year, we actually added in one tier down from Sony and from Samsung because we wanted to have more product in the event, and we had a huge amount of requests for these models. So we ascend with the times, and we listen to people and what they ask for, so we can hopefully make the event interesting to the broadest audience possible.
Well, that brings up a question that we've been covering the event, of course, on AVS Forum quite a bit. Mark, in fact, attended the event, and Mark, you're going to give us your impressions here in a minute. But before that, there have been quite a few comments from people saying, well, you're just showing these flagship super expensive TVs, you know, that most of us can't afford. What about the ones we can afford?
Well, all the models that are in the event is about the flagship TVs, but all the models that are in the event, you can scale it to what your needs are. First of all, the models started at $3,098 for Samsung's 64-inch, their largest flagship plasma, the F8500. They did go up to a very high number this year, $120,000. When we created the event, we never thought that there would be a TV for $120,000.
Right.
That TV comes in various sizes. It goes down to a 40-inch at $40,000, which is right behind me with that Barbcat in the scene. So
that's not a 40-inch TV. That's the 40,000 S9. Isn't that an 85-inch TV?
85-inch TV. Thank you.
Yeah.
85-inch TV. So that's where starts.
I'm sorry, Mark. What did you just say?
No, I understand. The S9 is an OLED small, and it's an LCD when it's big, which is an odd.
Oh, that's true. Correct. You know, that's correct. That's very weird. You're exactly right, because Samsung happens to use the term S9 to refer to both their LCD TVs, the large UHD TVs, and their smaller OLED or OLED TV, which is an S9C for curved. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But anyway, I see your point about wanting to really look at the flagships, or maybe one tier down from the flagship models, because you're really trying to see what the very best possible picture quality you can get. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the shootout, right?
Correct. Another example is in the 85-inch that we had here, the HU8550. That's available in 65-inch for $2,800. So you can scale this to what your needs are if you're not looking at a 85-inch screen size. The other is that these technologies tend to trickle down. So if we show you what's out today that's very high priced, you can depend on it being at CES. With all this high-end, great new technology at a lower price. So it's a little peek into the future of what we're going to be expecting down the road. One more thing about the model numbers. The KN55S9 differentiates it from the S9 that's a UN. UN standing for the beginning of the prefix for all the LCD-based panels.
Good point. Good point. And the KN is the OLEDs. Where they came up with U and K, I have no idea, but you know, model numbers could be the topic for a whole show. Mark, you were there, and at least one. It occurs over 2 days. This year, it was Saturday night and also Sunday afternoon. And Mark, you were there, and tell us your first impressions. Just as you walked in the door, what was it like for you to walk in that door and see all those TVs?
Well, let me start by saying that Robert is crazy for even doing this, because other retailers don't show calibrated televisions against each other, and just
crazy in a good way, I would say.
Yes, absolutely in a good way. So let me preface with what happened when I walked in last year. And last year when I walked in, there were three plasmas and a Sony UHD TV. And I was sure. I mean, I honestly was sure that the UHD TV from Sony was going to win. Because in that bright room and just with a still image on it, it looked fantastic. By the end of the night, I knew the plasmas, you know, had thoroughly trounced it. I honestly walked in this year thinking the same thing, that the LCDs had a chance at winning. I've just been blown away by the demos at CES and later at CE Week in New York. I just was thinking, you know, these panels have what it takes. By the end of the night, it was a more ambiguous weighing of the pros and cons of different technologies, the size you need, what your actual room lighting is, what kind of content you watch the most. I mean, there wasn't the same clarity. What there definitely was a much broader array of televisions in terms of sizes. So the first thing I thought was, wow, you know, that's really amazing. From 55 inches to 105 inches, you know, that's what the high and now encompasses. The first thing I saw was these huge TVs. It's hard to avoid that's what 2014 has brought us. Of course, along with that, those huge TVs rely on LCD technology because that's the technology that scales to those dimensions. And you know, so we're only talking about first impressions now. My first impression was that this is going to be a mighty battle and a very interesting shootout.
Now, Robert, last year you had like one UHD ultra high definition, sometimes called 4K TV. This year you had four, I believe, and they were all in a much larger size than the predominant size from last year. Tell us about the size range that you had with the UHDs and why you chose that.
They range from 78 inch, 79 and 85. And then of course the 105 inch, the 21.9, which is actually 2.37:1 CinemaScope.
Right.
We used the largest size primarily because we wanted to show the advantages of UHD from sitting back further. So you didn't have to get right up to it. We also thought it would be very fun to have that at the event. Where would you see a $120,000, 105-inch CinemaScope TV unless you went to the Consumer Electronics Trade Convention, which is to the trade only? So we thought that we would take advantage of this opportunity to show these products to the public. UHD needs to be on a large screen to really see and enjoy the beauty of fine resolution. It's a ratio of a screen size to viewing distance. Mm-hmm. And we can get that viewing distance further back if we use a larger screen.
Right. But doesn't that also limit the number of TVs that you can sort of put together? I mean, we have a photo, a couple photos of a wall OTVs, I called it. And hopefully John and Zach can find that one in my poor file names. There's a wall OTVs, which, by the way, I want to say Mark Henninger took all these pictures and he does a fabulous job taking photos, I have to say.
Absolutely.
So here we have the wall OTVs. Using such big ones, I can see a problem. One is that there's only so much wall space that you must have in that room. So that limits the number of TVs you can put up there. There's a wide angle shot. And, how do you deal with that? I mean, there's also the issue. These are all LCD TVs, these ultra high def ones. So that depending on where you're sitting, you might be very well off axis from one while you're right on axis for another. And as we all know, LCD TVs have off axis problems.
Oh, that's correct. And the off-axis problem is less of an issue on a larger screen. The larger the screen, the law of physics works in its favor. But more importantly, every year, even when it's plasmas only, we always make the audience or ask the audience to walk around as we're explaining each attribute with test patterns and content, particularly with test patterns, to get real close to each panel with their voting palette, dead center to each one, and determine your opinion from the test patterns on each individual TV. We judge them in a group after all the ballots are in. But the ballots are determined and voted independently to each television.
And we're going to talk about the ballots in a minute. I have that on my list of things to talk about. Before we do, though, let's see. You had, I believe, 8 TVs officially in the shootout, right, that were competing against each other. And people come in and they judge them on various criteria, which we, as I say, we'll talk about in a minute. There were some Samsungs, a couple of Sonys, a couple of LGs, at least one LG. Why were there some manufacturers not involved?
There's two reasons why some may not have been here. The majority of the reason was that the products weren't available. So we have a lot of mid-year introduction products. Also, as I mentioned earlier, there is the evaluation test that has to get passed as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some products aren't even available yet, and that's true. For example, many people are waiting with great anticipation for the Toshiba L9400, I believe, and also the Vizio P series and reference series. I'm wondering if it might not be worthwhile to think about putting this event a little later in the year to give more of those TVs a chance to come out, because as we all know, they introduce them at CES and then they come out anytime between the spring and the fall or even December.
Yeah. Well, in the 10 years of our event, they have ranged from very, very early May, which was last year, actually, till mid-October. And we do that based on exactly what you said. However, maybe things slip, but we plan this event fairly far in advance. And
sure.
We ask each manufacturer, what do you think you're going to be ready with mass production units that we can buy in bulk and then select randomly from our inventory? Mm. And we had been promised commitments from these manufacturers for that production would be available. It's not uncommon for it to slip by a week or two, which is what happened. And it's difficult to reschedule when you have people like Joe Kane and Dr. Larry Weber attending, and of course Mark attending, and our panel of experts attending. It's difficult to reschedule as we get closer to the event date. So I wasn't able to adjust the date any further.
Yeah, that's.
And
that's,
I'm sorry we missed those. I am too. We're buying them, of course. We're putting them up on the wall, and we'll continue. The wall stays up for the whole year, and we integrate mid-year introduction TVs into it.
And that's without even getting into the LG UHD TVs, which I think are the most anticipated televisions.
You mean the UHD OLEDs? You mean OLEDs?
Yeah, the OLEDs from
exactly.
LG. Yeah.
Right, which we're expecting the 65-inch sometime in the next month, I think, and then the 77-inch sometime after that. Robert, you mentioned Joe Kane and Larry Weber, and I wanted Mark to comment on their presentations, because part of this event, more than beyond simply evaluating these TVs and looking at them and seeing which one performs the best in different categories, there have been in the past, and this year was no different, presentations by some really heavyweights, industry experts. Joe Kane, who's the video guru of all video gurus, who's been on this show a number of times, gave a presentation. And Larry Weber, Dr. Larry Weber, is often credited as being the father of plasma TV. So, Mark, I know that you saw Joe's presentation. What did you think of that? And we have a picture of him actually saying something here.
Joe most certainly laid out a lot of the issues that need to be overcome if UHD is going to be a fully realized format, and that his main focus was that the interconnection between devices needs to be needs a lot more attention than it's getting with HDMI 2. You know, he advocated for greater bit depths, and I can say that every time I have seen the man speak, I have felt inspired and agree with him and hope that his advocacy is reaching the right ears and is acted upon.
There's Joe. That's, there's Joe.
Here he is telling you that if you're in Vegas, you know that red is much deeper and much richer than any red you see on a TV.
Right. And interesting, I don't know if you remember exactly which TVs those were, but just in that picture alone, and I'm sorry for those of you who can't see it, because the color of red is very different between those two. One, in one case, the one he's pointing to, it's really red. In the other case, it's distinctly orange. Was that your experience? Did you actually, is this photo accurately reflecting what's going on?
I need to discuss all of this for just 1 minute. On the right, you have the Sony XBR85X950B. To its left, you have the Samsung UN85HU8550. The camera is basically facing directly towards the Samsung, so it's getting the full resolution. I mean, the full color and the full contrast. The Sony is kind of off to the right. And you're actually looking at off angle from the camera. So what you're seeing is the loss in saturation caused by off angle viewing. I mean, that's a $25,000 Sony there. But yeah, you're 30 degrees off and it loses that. It's also possible that that's pretty much what happened with all the LCDs, and it's because they're using vertically aligned panels, so that head-on contrast really is extraordinary. There's only one IPS panel in that show, and it did perform the worst among all the TVs. So you know, there is something to be said for that head-on view. I guess what I wanted to discuss there is that in the show, you really had to use your memory to compare one television to another, because you can't stand in front of one television and then glance over to the one to the right or the left, because it's not a fair comparison at all. The best you can hope for is to stand between the two televisions and glance left and right.
But even that's not on that's not on axis for any of them.
Right, neither of them are looking their optimum. So there is a way around that. If you're one individual reviewer, you can aim all the televisions directly towards your seat and then rotate, and then you can look at them all face on. But just because of the practical realities of having an audience and the way the shootout is orchestrated, they all have to face straight out. And therefore, as Robert noted, to really evaluate them, you have to look at them head on. So what you're seeing here is the camera looking head on at the one picture and then capturing the other one from an angle. Mm-hmm. And the additional loss of saturation that results in. And many of the pictures I took are off angle, and you can see the various colors and degrees of loss of black levels that occur with the LCDs when you do that.
Yeah. Robert, there's probably no way around it if you have an audience. Speaking of which, let me ask you real quick, how many people did attend this event this year?
Over the 2 days, 137.
And so obviously they can't all be looking at all the LCDs on axis at the same time. That's impossible.
That's correct. And that's why the walking around and facing each TV is critical. And I agree with Mark. There's no real great answer. You do have to have a little bit of memory from where you just left off. It's not as critical or hard to do when there's test patterns up there. A little bit more detail, a little more difficult with content, video content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the calibration. I know you guys, we don't have a calibrator here, unfortunately. Kevin Miller was going to be here, and he got a gig at the last minute getting ready for Cedia, which is less than 3 weeks away. Holy smokes. But I do have a couple of photos of the calibrators, and I just want to make sure everybody sees those and some of the calibration patterns that were used to evaluate. Here's one pattern, for example. Showing how they're setting color and tint. Mark, tell us a little bit about this picture.
Well, some of the televisions have a blue-only mode, and what you can do with that is compare the luminosity of the individual colors as reproduced when it's only blue, and what you should see is basically a continuous field of blue with those black squares in the middle instead of varying shades of that blue.
Of blue, right.
Yeah, if you saw varying shades, then either your saturation or your hue are off. And in modern televisions, it would almost certainly just be the saturation, because the hue control
usually correct. Right. Those middle two TVs don't have either. They don't have their blue only mode on, or they probably don't, so that you can see what the full color image looks like. That when you turn the blue only mode on, it should look like that. Look like those blue ones.
I suspect they were just turning it on for each one, but not every television has that capability.
Right. And when they don't, of course, then you have to use those blue filters that come with the setup discs like the Spears and Munsell or the Joe Kane disc.
Right.
They come with these blue filters that you put over your eyes and you can sort of do the same thing. The problem is that those filters don't work the same from one TV to another. So it's much nicer to have the blue only mode if the TV has it. That's to me a pretty big selling point for setting it up to look its best, which is what we want to do here. Robert, tell us a little bit about content distribution. I assume you were playing the same content on all these TVs. How is that set up?
That was one of the most difficult obstacles this year, because UHD has now moved to HDMI 2.0 with 60 frames per second, and there is no switching equipment. And I can tell you that I drove all of those equipment manufacturers crazy by haunting them to please give me an engineering sample or some way that I can pass purely a UHD at 60. We finally settled on Key Digital with a 8x8 matrix switch, so we have the 8 outputs fit with 8 inputs of UHD 2160p at 24 or 30 frames per second. So we were a little bit limited there. But we also had Samsung and Sony's handmade UHD at 60 frames per second. Each one had 4 to 5 outputs. So we were able to show content out of those two devices in UHD at 60 frames per second. The other thing is, when we were showing UHD content, the 1080p displays went blank.
Right, because of course they can't. They don't know what to do with UHD content coming in. Now, I'm a little surprised. Were you able to – the Sony server, which I think is what you're talking about here, which provided the UHD content, as far as I know, only works with Sony TVs, and the same with the Samsung.
Yes. That is true. But both companies provided special samples for us. And they had – so Sony made a – 4-output HDMI 2.0 chipset with beautiful 4K 60 frame per second content. Mm. And Samsung made the same thing with 5 outputs for us. This is not a normal product. We tested them. There was no clipping or anything. They worked perfectly. So we had those two devices, and they worked on any brand TV.
Oh, wow.
We did have some problem passing PC level. Joe Kane had some beautiful 4K content that we had some trouble because PC levels coming out of the PC seemed to be lower, so we were losing our sync every once in a while, which was a little bit frustrating at times.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine. Joe was particularly frustrated.
Yeah, we had all the televisions showing beautiful 1080p at all, so you can see all the TVs with 1080p, of course, on the UHDs there. They can only display it at UHD, so they would upconvert those.
They would upconvert, right.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a minute as well. Yeah. M5 in the chat room says, "In all the pictures I saw from even the far left TV image looks out of proportion. Everything looks wider. Any reason for that?" Mark, I would assume maybe because you were using a somewhat wide-angle setting on your lens to get that much information in the picture?
Yes, they'll look stretched out just like the TV behind me when you shoot at an angle. You'd have to shoot straight on to get the proportions to look normal.
Right, right. Another test pattern I was really interested in was the red test pattern, and I know we have a picture of that as well. There it is. That shows a lot. Tell us what we're looking at here, Mark.
Well, from the bottom, we're looking at the Samsung OLED on the left and the LG OLED on the right. In the middle, we're looking at the Samsung something or other 9000 UHD.
HU 9000.
Right. And then next to that, we're looking at the less expensive Sony in the show, the XBR 79. X900B. And on top, we're looking at the Samsung F8500 plasma. So what you really see here is that the LCDs have uniformity issues that just, you know, you can't avoid it. And you also see with the F8500 that it has a vertical viewing angle issue that causes it to darken near the top. And It just happened to be that because it was that high, if you're really up close in that audience, it would dim like that. So you're seeing the various effects of viewing angle issues on the three top TVs, and on the bottom you're seeing the fact that OLED, at least as far as screen uniformity and as far as the viewing angle goes, you know, they both actually look pretty good. There were some viewing angle issues with the OLEDs, so I wanted to address that. And specifically on the left with that Samsung, you see that it doesn't look the same as the others in terms of how it's rendering that that red.
The Samsung's on the lower left, right?
On the lower left, right. And it
looks very bright. It looks like the sort of brightest, reddest. It's a little bit orangey, perhaps.
Yeah, it's orangey, and that's the odd thing. From a significant off angle, I don't want to be like from a slight off angle. From a significant off angle, everything kind of became orangey with that Samsung, and it has something to do with how the RGB OLED is arrayed, as opposed to the way the LG has white OLEDs in there. I mean, I don't know the technical details, but there's an off angle thing, and it makes everything become orangey, including red. As you can see here, I actually took this as a very dark exposure so that it wasn't clipping the reds, so that you could actually see, you know, what's really going on. So yeah, like I said, what this picture shows you is a limited vertical viewing angle in the F8500. It shows you screen uniformity issues with the two LCDs. It shows you a hue-related viewing angle issue with that Samsung, and it pretty much shows you why that LG won.
Well, you've spilled the beans here. Everybody on NAVS already knows who won. I was kind of waiting for the end of the show for that, but that's all right. That's no problem. That's all right. It's all right. Because the winner, actually, the declared winner actually turns out to be a bit of an interesting story in and of itself, which we'll get to. But Robert, I wanted to ask you first, and somebody in the chat room also made this comment or asked this question, and I can't find it right at the moment, is that the F8500 plasma, the only plasma in this year's shootout, was very high up on the wall. Now, the reason, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the reasons that it was there in the first place is that it won last year, right?
That is correct, and it is a carryover product for the first half of this year through the end of the calendar year. And listen, I have to admit it. It was a disadvantage because it was up so high. It still did remarkably well because plasma will do that, especially one as good as that one. Mm-hmm. But it was disadvantaged, and I apologize for that. In spite of that, it shares the winning crown.
Yeah, so, indeed. Yeah. But I guess you probably had to put it up that high because there wasn't any place else to put it, maybe? I don't know.
Well, that's the reason, yes. Yep. And we hope to move this to a larger venue for 2015 so that we can have more product in there and have them all equally spaced and equally positioned in one eye level.
Mm-hmm. One thing, before we get off to that, and of course the F8500 plasma has this anti-reflective filter on it, which is sometimes called a louver filter, which causes exactly what that picture shows and what Mark was talking about, which is that as you go off axis vertically above or below the screen, the brightness, the amount of light that reaches your eye drops off quite a bit. So that was another unfortunate thing that happened about that plasma. And yet, holy smokes, it still came out really well, as we will talk about. Now, we have much more to talk about here, but before we do, I want to take a moment and thank everyone who is watching this show or listening to this show, because you're obviously fans of Twit. And many of you, I'm sure, shop on Amazon. I mean, who doesn't? I do. Most people do, and for good reason. It's a great way to find what you need. And now there's a way to support Twit while you're shopping at Amazon. I mean, what could be better than that? You already know that the price, selection, and convenience of Amazon.com. And as I said, you can now help support Twit with your Amazon purchases. It's so easy. You just go to twit.tv/Amazon and click on the Amazon banner there at the right of the screen. And boom, you're in Amazon. Costs you nothing extra. And anything you purchase there will certainly help keep the lights on at the Brick House, which we certainly would love to keep happening. Now, when you go to that twit.tv/Amazon page, you'll see a number of products that are featured, one of which I want to bring to your attention, which just appeared there recently. It's a book by Andy Weir called The Martian. It's a novel. I haven't read it yet, but it is certainly one thing I'm going to purchase immediately because the story sounds very intriguing. It's about an astronaut, one of the first to land on Mars, and he gets into all kinds of trouble and has to survive somehow. One of my favorite kinds of stories, sort of based in reality, near future. It's a great story. And Andy Weir, the author, was on Triangulation a couple of weeks ago talking about this book and other stuff, I'm sure. So I do want to recommend that book. I haven't read it yet myself, but I have no doubt, none whatsoever, that it's going to be a fascinating read, and I'm really looking forward to it. One of the other things you can do is go to Amazon Prime, and if you're an Amazon Prime member, they have tons of movies to watch. Some of the more recent ones that have been added to Amazon Prime, one of my favorites is Amadeus. Now, that's not a new movie, of course. It's been out for quite a while, but it is certainly one of my favorite movies of all time. F. Murray Abraham is fantastic. Tom Hulce is amazing as Mozart. And I knew the guy who was the music director of that show, of that movie, and he did a fabulous job. So I do want to recommend that. That's just recently come into Amazon Prime, as has Robin Hood, Men in Tights, the Mel Brooks take on the Robin Hood story, which is so funny. And I have to tell you that I actually spent 2 days on the set of that movie in a Renaissance band that was in the fair when Robin came to do his archery contest. And I went to the theater thinking, oh, boy, I get to see myself on screen. I was on the cutting room floor. Not a moment of it was I on, but it was still fun. You know, I got to see how movies are made. It was really pretty cool. So that's just two of many, many movies that have just been added, much less all the ones that are there already. So it's all perfect. It's all very available to you simply by going to Amazon. And we sure do appreciate it if you go there via twit.tv/Amazon. That banner on the right-hand side is where you click to get in. You can even go there from the UK and Canada. So it's not only limited to those in the US. And again, whatever you buy, please make sure to click through the Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon. It's an easy way to support Twit. You can also bookmark that page. I certainly have. And click through our link every time you shop there. And there are even, links for Amazon UK and Canada. Once again, that's twit.tv/Amazon, and we thank you so much for your support. Okay, here's a question for you. We've been talking about UHD. UHD TVs are here, obviously. They made a big, big appearance at the shootout. Robert, I was wondering, have you ever considered dividing the competition into divisions, you know, the UHD division and the 1080p division or HD division, and declaring a winner in each of them and then having a best in show over and above that?
We have considered that, and I think that still is a good idea. But I have a lot of advisors in this, and most advisors told me, let them all be in the shootout together and may the best one win. And I guess we, at the end, we decided to go with that. I think that is a good idea.
Mm. You know, it's like a dog show, right? You got your, yeah, your best German Shepherd, your best poodle, whatever, and then there's best in show. Because as you said before, you had some special UHD servers that were showing UHD content on the UHD sets, but the 1080p sets could not show them.
That was an issue.
Yes, Mark?
That came up on the forums many members expressed the desire to see real, like, cinematic content playing, the same content playing in 1080p and native UHD at the same time. They thought that that was what was missing from the shootout that would have potentially pushed, you know, votes for the UHD TVs up a bit higher, maybe for the just the overall image quality category. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that a lot of people really wanted to see that direct comparison of native 1080p versus native 2160p of the same actual cinematic content playing concurrently. Not sure if that's doable.
I don't know if that's doable. As you say, exactly so. I think that would be very, very hard to do because you would need separate servers and they would have to be synchronized somehow. Mm-hmm. I suppose if you had servers that were capable of reading time code, you could do it, but that sounds like a very expensive proposition. And otherwise, how would you do that? It's a good question. Robert, that's maybe something to think about for next year. I don't even know if there's a possible way to do it, but if there were, it would be very interesting, don't you think?
Absolutely. I like that idea as well. And I just wanted to comment that I read a review where, or maybe David told me this, David Katzmaier told me he does that. And he'll play the Blu-ray disc, and then he'll take the HD pack from Samsung with the same movie in UHD, mastered in UHD, and try to get the time sync as best as he can by speeding up one or the other. And he tells me he does that, and I know he does, and it's a very brilliant idea. We tried it. We couldn't coordinate it amongst the 8 TVs to work properly. So we didn't do it this year. But, Mark, I think that's a great idea, and I think we're going to promote you from attendee to advisor.
All right. Nice. You heard it here first, folks. I love it.
Pretty cool. Thanks.
Robert, you're about to say something?
Well, I was going to mention, I hate to go backwards, but on that louver filter, I just wanted to tell you that the louver filter is designed to be much more aggressive on overhead lighting than it is on light that comes from below, for good reason, because it's usually overhead lighting that disturbs it. So the louver filter from down below is not as aggressive. Also, it was really bad in the front row. As you moved back to the second and third row, the louver filter wasn't there. So it only affected those in the front row. And of course, Mark gets a front row seats.
Yeah, no, what I saw was that if you stood up, it got brighter. It was when you were sitting and in the front row, at least on the first night. I don't know if you tilted it down on the second night, and I was really just pointing out that you could see that happening in the photo.
Absolutely.
You know.
Right. And that was a question in the chat room was, you know, why not tilt it downward? And I guess you did on the second night, right?
It was actually tilted down the first night, but not enough. We didn't realize how far forward all the seats had to go until we put out these 100-plus seats. So we didn't know that we were going to be that close to the device, and we didn't tilt it enough. It was a very gradual tilt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, next up I want to talk about the evaluation process. Basically, all these people come in, and I guess we should start by saying that most of the members of the audience, the people who come in and participate, we'd want to probably call them video enthusiasts or videophiles, right? I mean, they're not just Joe Blows off the street, right?
100% absolutely true. Many came from the forums, AVS forum and all the other forums. Many were professional cinematographers, directors, TV evaluators came as well. So the audience was a very high-end audience. This is not the general public here.
Right. And so they come in, they're confronted with these 8 TVs. I believe you give them some pieces of paper, some forms to fill out, right?
Well, in advance of it, we do have an application form that's very brief. But the form that they get when they come in, when they register, is actually the voting ballot.
Mm. And we have a picture of...
We also give them the contrast ratios and all the measurements that we took. And I have that here. If you want me to hold it in front of the camera, I could do that.
Well, actually, I have a picture of Mark's ballot.
Oh, that's great.
That he filled out. There it is right there. So on the left-hand side, you can see each of the TVs. And across the top, you can see the 6 picture quality characteristics or parameters, attributes, if you want, that are being voted upon, which are black level, I can't read them 100% well there, Mark. Why don't you go through them with me?
Oh, I'm sorry. My actual numbers?
No. The categories.
black level, contrast ratio, color accuracy, yep. motion yep. resolution, and just general sharpness during actual content. Day mode, which is looking at the material in the store with the lights on. And general content video quality, your actual impression of how things look.
Right. So that's your impression of this TV looks great or mediocre or not mm-hmm. so great or whatever. It's the overall catch-all sort of category, I guess, right?
Yes. And a lot of people asked me, like, why I had the numbers that I had, for example, for color accuracy. And the answer is that I graded that particular category not just looking at it straight on. I took points off of the OLEDs. I just want to note this for the off-angle viewing issues that I saw.
Mm. Even on the OLEDs?
Yeah, on the OLEDs, specifically on the OLEDs.
Yeah, that, yeah. You expect that on LCD, but I didn't expect that on OLED.
Yes.
Which is just so weird. Okay, so I guess Robert, the voting is on a scale of 1 to 10, I believe, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so everybody gets this sheet, and they mark down their numbers for each TV. And can people vote if they've only been to one day, not both days?
Usually people are here only one day.
I gotcha. Okay. So how many votes did you get total then? How many people actually voted? You said you had 130-some people actually attend.
That's over the 2 days, but not everybody is permitted to vote because they might be the manufacturer. So we don't permit them to vote. I don't have that exact number in front of me, but I know it's about 80.
Okay, so roughly 80. We'll call it roughly 80. That's fine. And so everybody votes. They walk around, they look at the TVs, hopefully straight on the money as well as off axis maybe, and evaluate these six different criteria. And they hand in their ballots, and then you take them. And what do you do with them?
We tabulate them, and we see how many categories each panel won in. So we tabulate how many categories they've won in. And we like contrast ratio best of all. We like black level contrast ratio particularly because that's mm-hmm. the combination of peak luminance as well as black. And we look at the total number as well, the full number of votes for each product. But it's heavily weighted, I would say, towards how many categories they win.
Okay, but each of the categories is weighted as well, correct?
Well, they're all 1 point with the exception of contrast ratio, and we look at that as 2 points because we look at, as most reviewers do, and as ISF even set out standards, contrast ratio being most important attribute. So that gets 2 for every one. And then instead of the 7 categories, we have 6 categories, we divide the number by 7. And that's how we come up with overwhelming decisions that we make. But there's other decisions. How many categories did they win in? What's the total if you counted it without weighting it? So there's a few different parameters and ways that we judge, which is what made it difficult last year and this year to come up with a winner.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ways to statistically look at the data.
Exactly. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. But first, there's a couple of people in the chat room who are wondering about quote unquote blind testing, which obviously you can't do without seeing the screens. But is there any way to obscure the maker of each set? I mean, when you're in there looking at these TVs, you know what's a Sony and you know what's a Samsung and so on. I don't see any way to get around that other than to actually build a wall in which the bezel and the logo and all that stuff is invisible.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't even conceal it because as soon as the menu comes up, thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. As soon as the menu comes up, you know which brand it is.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't even really help. We ask people to be very honest and very mature about this. Leave their personal agendas home. Just look at picture quality. We don't care about 3D. We don't care about smart features. We don't care about your past experience, good or bad, or your partialness. Just judge this on picture quality. And please leave everything else out of this room. And I think people are genuine. genuine and honest about that, but I can't control the people really.
Mark, what did you have to say about that?
Well, you'd easily be able to figure it out in this show because you'd know that the OLEDs were 55 inches and curved, and you would know that the larger curved UHD was a Samsung. You know, if you just generally knew the list of TVs in the competition, you'd certainly know which one the 105-inch one was. So right. It just seems like you'd trying to hide them wouldn't help.
It just doesn't work.
Easily identified. It doesn't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a really big deal, because what you really saw at that competition is that it was difficult to declare a winner because the emissive displays all scored incredibly close to each other, and then all the transmissive displays, the LCDs, also scored incredibly close to each other. The gap was between those two fundamental, you know, ways of getting the image out of the screen.
Mm-hmm. And we should make sure that everybody understands that emissive displays are those in which the pixels emit their own light, which is OLED and plasma. And transmissive displays are those which transmit light through a layer, which means LCD. So there you have those two particular things. So NLE guy says, yeah, right, no agenda. We're human beings. We can't be completely objective. It's not possible. But I think, Robert, your point is very good, to just say, look, do the best you can. I mean, what else can you do?
Yeah. You know, there's several issues with the LCD-based panels. They can't close the doors all the way, so they have light leakage coming through. An emissive pixel, each individual pixel is its own local dimming zone at many different luminance levels. It's so much more accurate of a picture, much more photographic looking.
Right, exactly. Oh, and that brings up dimming zones, and I wanted to talk about that briefly. Of the LCDs, as you say, the emissive displays, they have each individual pixel is dimmable. So, you know, they have 2.2 million dimmable zones in the case of a plasma, a 1080p set. The LCDs, there are two types of illumination. One is where the LCDs are in an array behind the LCD panel, and the other is in which the LCDs are LEDs are along the edges, are mounted along the edges of the screen, and some very sophisticated optical panels are used to bring that light out in and through the LCD panel. Of the four LCDs that were there, which were all UHD, there were at least a couple that were full array local dimming, or FALD, and there were a couple that were edge lit, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's correct, if you're asking me. I call it direct lit, but full array local dim is a more common way of calling it.
Yeah.
And there were two full array local dimmed or direct lit ones, and there were three that were edge lit, actually.
Mm. Okay, and one question that came up before the show started was, how can you tell how many zones there are? For these FALD or direct lit sets, the LEDs behind the screen are organized into a series of zones, relatively large compared to the size of the LEDs themselves, and certainly really large compared to the size of the individual pixels. And a lot of manufacturers who make these direct lit or FALD sets will not tell you how many zones, local dimmable zones, they have. Vizio is a notable exception. The M series has 32. The E series has 12 or 16, which is very low. It should be higher than that. Mark, didn't you say that somebody at this event explained how you can tell how many zones there are?
I'm going to have to pass that one to Robert because...
Oh, okay. I made a mistake.
I could describe it, but Robert knows exactly what those guys did because I think they figured this one out.
Okay, Robert, what do you say?
Well, actually, a gentleman, another enthusiast who's very popular in the forums, Dr. David Shank, and myself, and mostly Dr. Shank, developed a method of counting the zones. It's proprietary to us, but it's a very simple one. So I guess this is no big deal if we get copied here. And I think we're the only ones who have ever counted the actual amount of local dimming zones. And what it is basically, and you can do it at home yourself with a computer and a mouse, make the screen zero luminance, make it black, get the computer hooked up to it with a white mouse pointer on it, turn the contrast and brightness up, and run that mouse pointer on the left-hand edge of the screen slowly, and you can see it going from one zone to another. You can see the zones lighting up. You see how large they are, and you count them, and then run across the top of the screen. So David McKenzie actually furthered that design that Dr. Shank and I developed to automate it on a PC. And he has this beautiful little white box that goes up and down and counts the zones automatically.
Wow.
And we demonstrated that. So we actually count the local dimming zones, and it's a very effective and accurate way of doing it. The manufacturers didn't want to admit it and didn't want us to release it probably. Some of them were quite good. The X950B had a good amount of zones. Obviously, the S9 had a lot of zones. And some of the edge-lit ones were able to produce more local dimming zones, even though they're edge-lit. They do have local dimming, as hard as it is to explain that with their magical way of doing it.
You know, I always, when the edge-lit said, I always put the words local dimming in quotes because
I know.
I can't believe that it's really that good, but this is a fabulous test. I had never thought of that before. I really must try it. That's great. Thank you.
Works great. Thank you.
Yeah. M5 in the chat room is asking, does anyone keep stats on the viewing position, the seating position, the different angles for TVs of the ones voting versus the scores? He's wondering if there's a pattern there. And Robert, you said that you encourage people to get up and walk around and look at all the TVs on axis. So I don't think you keep track of, you know, which score came from which angle, so to speak.
We haven't. That's not a bad idea either, though. And but I think we try to overcome it the best we can by having them parade around. We try to do it in an organized single file way to move them through. We give them a time limit. When they have only a few minutes left, the presenter raises his hand and says, you have 2 more minutes to do your voting. So we try to make some sense of it. And Mark, we did that so much better the second night than we did the first night. So I'm sorry that you didn't come back the second night.
Boy, you know what? You learn stuff each time, I'm sure, Robert. You learn stuff each night and then each event so that next year you can continually do quality improvement, which I'm sure is one of your goals.
Absolutely. So true. Thanks for saying that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. It's time now to talk about the winners. And we've already mentioned them and alluded to them, but let's come straight out and say this was the first year, Robert, that you actually declared a tie, which I find very, very interesting. Who were the two winners?
It's LG's brand new OLED, and we had a mass-produced example of that here. It was beautiful. It's the 55EC9300. Had some nice improvements from the first generation that's only 8 months old. So they had some nice upgrades in that. And then the winner to share the crown with them, and again, like you said, in 10 years, we never did this before, was the winner of last year, the Plasma F8500. And interestingly, even though it was disadvantaged as being so high, and some people have commented that some firmware that helped fix some luminance pops, so to speak, actually may have lowered the brightness and maybe even MLL, it still scored so very well. So it was very tough between those three displays.
Right, exactly. And I wanted to point out that the popular vote by the audience basically came up with a tie. And I want to talk about how those votes can be looked at one way or another to see which one actually came in front. But then the calibrators, Kevin, David, and Dwayne, vote for their favorite display among all of the TVs there. And they unanimously chose the Samsung OLED. I found that very interesting.
That's correct. They did. And they had reasons of better uniformity in some issues and possibly even some better color, as well as flatter gamma. And that's these attributes are important to these guys, and they were not alone in selecting that one as the best. I don't think I should share with you some of the other top professional reviewers that were in the room that actually also agreed with them. Now, by the numbers, they didn't win, but it was so close, and they're so much more similar than they are different. And one's a total dedicated RGB OLED lamps, and the other one is a bigger white all OLED with filtering, so to speak, that might come in front of them to make the subpixels of RGB. So Dr. Weber had a fantastic presentation that was technical, but yet super easy to understand how these two different OLED technologies perform and how they operate. It was very, very informative.
I'm really sorry I missed that. I'm hoping to get Dr. Weber on this show to talk about his illustrious career with plasma and now the new display technologies, because he's a very, very smart guy and an interesting guy as well. So, yeah, Sound Pro 69 says, popular vote. Do they have an electoral college? No. the LG 55 EC 9300, which, by the way, costs $3,500 list, which is amazing considering that LG's first 55-inch OLED just over a year ago was $15,000, one in one sense, and the F8500 plasma, the winner from last year, won in a different sense. What were those two senses? What were the two ways to parse the data?
Well, again, we look at the way we always look at it every year, where we slightly weight heavier, just contrast ratio. We always look at how many categories each product wins in. And then we look at the average numbers as well. It was so difficult, again, to claim a winner. It was very clear that everybody voted very strongly towards the three emissive displays. And very consistently amongst the LCD panels. So it was easy to know that it was one of those three. And in this case, you might even consider two or three of them as so close. Yeah. In fact, they are. So very tough voting. We had to dig hard and for long at looking at these numbers. LG won in three out of the six categories.
I thought they won four out of six.
I'm sorry. Thank you. They did. They won. I'm just looking over. I'm sorry to have to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, you're right.
That's all right.
Four out of six categories, and that weighs heavily with us as well. And sure. As far as their loss, if you just counted everything as 1 point with no weighting, it was 0.5 of 1 point that the F8500 eked out a popular vote win. But even that is ridiculously close. To take it by 0.5, a half of a point, is how much they won by popular vote over the EC9300. So it was a very, very, very small win by the popular vote and a very decisive win. If you look at the amount of categories, the importance of the categories, it was very decisive for the EC9300. But the performance level in every category wasn't that far away as it was with the LCD panels. What we need to do with LCD, if we're going to continue with LCD, is make UHD more compelling like Joe Kane is teaching us.
Yes.
Give us more. Mark, give us a bigger color palette. Give us a little more frame rate. And definitely, above all of that, give us high dynamic range.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't agree more. Mark, what were your votes? How did you end up what was your winner?
Well, I absolutely voted for the F8500. I would say that I even allowed it some handicap because I know how well it performs. And seeing it. But beyond that, by one single point, if you just add it up, I chose the Samsung OLED over the LG. And to look at it, I did it because of how I viewed the way it rendered motion. And if there was one thing I was looking at in all the TVs that's a priority for me, it's that motion rendering. Granted, I need the blacks to be really great, but motion resolution is something that I really enjoy out of my plasma, and something that, to my eyes, the LG had to work on, and that the Samsung had a bit over it. So that was actually the decisive category. But I absolutely picked the F8500. it was the most color accurate from the most angles, how I would describe it. And that really appealed to me.
Interesting how different people, what you just said just brought up something to me, which is that different people might weigh different categories differently. So somebody might think,
talk about that for a second. Absolutely. Because
we only have a second left. So go for it quickly.
I'll go for it quick. On AVS Forum, a lot of people discuss how they watch TV. This event is biased towards people who will watch the highest possible quality content in a light controlled environment. That gives a very distinct advantage to those emissive TVs. The LCDs perform a lot better in the kind of environments that are typical that people, that they're watching television, not a Blu-ray. They're watching in their living room. The windows might be open. Those LCDs are often the best choice, for that, because also their viewing distance is greater. So there's... To be negative towards those TVs is to really misunderstand the exact context of the vote that took place there. That's all I want to say. They're all pretty amazing TVs, and depending on your needs, some of those UHD TVs could in fact be the better TV for you. There's no question about that, irrespective of these votes.
I know we're near the end, but I just wanted to add that unusually so, the F8500 is very, very bright. And the OLEDs are bright. I'm sorry, I was trying to get my glasses on to read it, but I think they put out at peak luminance about 100-foot lamberts. So they really stand up next to the LCDs in high ambient light. Also, their black level is not crushed when the ambient light is turned up.
Right. And the results, by the way, the results of the shootout are on AVS Forum, and I'm sure on valueelectronics.com as well, where you can see the results of the voting, as well as the ANSI contrast measurements and the black level and peak white levels on all of the contenders as well. And so I do encourage you to go there and check it out. Well, you know what? We are out of time, and it's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. And all I can say is I hope I make it to number 11 next year.
I hope you do as well.
So thank you both very much. Robert Zoen, president of Value Electronics and host of this amazing event, which hopefully will continue into the future. And I certainly look forward to being there. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I really enjoyed this very much.
Good. And Mark Henninger, of course, my cohort in crime at avsforum.com. I sure was glad you were there this year and took such great pictures and had so many interesting things to share with us today. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Most informative event of the year. Definitely. Got a great deal out of it. Thank you, Robert. And thanks, Scott. Love being on
you
the
bet.
Show.
You bet. So Robert's website, as I mentioned before, is valueelectronics.com. And you can find me and Mark both at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg. And you can find us on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/hometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Iverson. He is the web monkey for the websites of Stereophile, Sound and Vision, Inner Fidelity, Analog Planet, and several others of great interest to this audience. And he's going to be talking about his very interesting perspective on blind audio testing, has to do with the high resolution audio test that I'm conducting on AVS Forum. And he's got some, might we say, controversial things to say about it. So I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.